Right now, let's begin with talking about a very serious side of protecting and fighting for reporters who challenge powerful nations, violent insurgencies, and rich and powerful commercial interests, controlling everything from illicit drugs to agriculture and water resources. The state of press freedom and its bravest warriors. Warriors like Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter released from prison by Iran this week, or the team of journalists at Tolo TV in Afghanistan killed by a Taliban suicide bomber. Joel Simon is executive director for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Nazila Fati is author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She's a former Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Both Joel and Nazila are relieved and alarmed by what happened to Jason Rezaian.
I'm very happy that he is out of prison. He's back here, but I don't think he should have been there in the first place. He was a reporter, and I never saw him write anything controversial or provocative. The fact that he was arrested in the first place and the fact that he was held for 500 days in a notorious prison is very alarming. And I don't think it's going to make things easier for other reporters who are still in Iran and working. It just shows how unpredictable the situation is, how unreliable Iranian authorities are. And I think all the other reporters who are in Iran feel that they're not safe there.
Jason had become a kind of judicial hostage. He was in jail it had nothing to do with his journalism. This was clear. The entire legal process was a farce. It was transparently manipulated. So he was taken because of this suspicion by the Revolutionary Guards. They were apparently suspicious of his reporting, and he was taken to leverage certain advantages politically in terms of the international environment, and Iran essentially was successful in that effort. So he was a judicial hostage, and he's free to a certain extent because the ransom was paid.
I don't want to be annoying or, I don't know, superficial here, but I think it does bear comparison, the Flint water crisis and the timing of U.S. journalists getting on that story, and a story like Tolo TV, which has confronted aggressively the Taliban. Tell that story and how you see their mission and their vulnerability here in this environment where journalists in places like this are extraordinarily vulnerable.
Well, this is in Afghanistan, and Tolo TV really is a groundbreaking media enterprise. It's the Mohseni family, which was – they were sort of exiled during the Taliban period, and they had some resources. Saad Mohseni was living in Australia. He brought that to bear, invested it in Afghanistan, attracted additional international investment, and created this truly independent media network that not only covers the news, it brings in cultural programming, soap operas, talent shows. It really has transformed the media environment. And aside from the Taliban, of course, Afghanistan's a very conservative place. So this sort of had repercussions throughout the society. And of course, the challenging way that it covered government activities brought pressure to bear from the government. So Tolo TV is a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon. It really is a quite a remarkable media enterprise in an environment in which there's never been free media. And the Taliban essentially declared Tolo TV a media target because of their critical coverage. And now it appears they've carried out that threat.
Nazila, your colleague, Rukmini Kalamachi, did some amazing reporting last year, which really showed that Al-Qaeda, for instance, creates this kind of transaction in hostage-taking that includes journalists putting prices on people's heads. How has that had an impact on the way journalists see themselves reporting in the Middle East?
Well, if you remember, it all started with Daniel Pearl, who was kidnapped in Afghanistan, and he was the first journalist who was beheaded in the beginning of the war. So I think that was the most alarming message that was sent to reporters. And since then, people who were working in these areas were very, very aware that they were targets, that the Taliban, various terrorist groups, could take them as hostages. And later on, since then, there have been many, many others whose lives have been taken because of this. And I think this is the first time, the past decade almost, that reporters who were just messengers, who were people who were carrying the message, they thought they were empowering people by giving them information, they've become targets themselves. It undermines what they are doing when they have to constantly worry about their own security and safety. It limits their ability to cover issues, to go to places. And this is not good for journalism at all, not good for journalists per se, and not good for what happens afterwards, the information that comes out of it.
Joel, a citizen journalist armed with digital tools were seen as a way of pushing back when Western reporters or large media outlets in Europe and the United States couldn't get into report in places. We've seen this month that perhaps that is not a countermeasure. And you talk about something called new censorship in thinking about the way people are responding to some of these journalist vulnerabilities. Explain.
Linking the things we're talking about today, we have Jason Rezaian in prison for 18 months. He's the correspondent for The Washington Post. I mean, if you were the correspondent for The Washington Post 15 years ago, for example, you had a force field around you. Nobody would touch you. You had this incredible protection because of your visibility. And then we have the attack on Tolo TV, eight media workers killed in Afghanistan. And if you look at the data, this is the most deadly and dangerous time for journalists ever. More journalists in prison, more journalists being killed. So what's happening out there? We have a very complex media environment where where journalists who once collectively exercised this kind of information monopoly, if you wanted to communicate to the world, even if you were a bad guy, you had to talk to the journalists. That's no longer the case. Governments, non-state actors have other ways of communicating, so journalists are more vulnerable. And you have, as you described, citizen journalists, local journalists, non-journalists who are using these journalistic tools participating in this activity of gathering and disseminating information to the public. But they're incredibly vulnerable. They don't have institutions behind them. They don't have governments behind them. They don't have that visibility. And so we have a very robust information environment, but the people who are bringing us the news have never been more vulnerable.
Is the New York Times press credential, Nazila, a force field anymore?
I'm not sure. When I left the country, when I left Iran in 2009, I left under huge pressure. So I think things had started to change in Iran as well. I mean, in Iran, I was always respected as a New York Times reporter. I had access to people. But all along, I knew there was another force in the country that was trying to target me. I was summoned every once in a while for interrogation. I was threatened. There were times that my press credentials were taken away. And so I was always very aware that while the New York Times gave me some protection, it gave me huge visibility, it also made me a target. I could always be a potential hostage, but I didn't know what the purposes would be and how long they would hold me to get what they want. Jason's case was a very scary one because he was held for 500 days. Before Jason, everybody else was released within 3 months. So I'm not sure if any reporter has any kind of protection because of other news organizations.
Joel Simon, before we go, you commented on the media environment now. Contrast the publications and the very glossy ISIS-generated media materials, which reach the same people as journalists who are presumably making the decision as citizens of these vulnerable societies, and some in the United States and Canada, whether they want to join up. They're evaluating whether ISIS is a legitimate operation or not, and they have the ISIS magazine versus, you know, The Economist to choose from.
Well, I mean, I think what the ISIS magazine shows is just that anyone can participate in this media environment. These tools, I mean, we obviously the Islamic State has been quite effective in utilizing Twitter and other social media tools. They publish this glossy magazine that looks like journalism, and it's very effective in terms of their ability to communicate with the people they want to communicate with, including their followers and people they want to inspire around the world. And this is why they kill journalists, because they don't need them. They don't need them. I mean, when you, 15, 20 years ago, when you were in the field and you would encounter folks like ISIS as a journalist, you would say, if you kill me, who's going to tell your story? I'm sure that's what Danny Pearl said. That's not an argument that wins the day anymore because they have other ways of communicating. You're dispensable. In some cases, you're more valuable as a prop in a terror video.
Joel Simon is executive director for the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of The New Censorship Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. Also with us was Nazila Fati, who's the author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran, and former Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Nazila and Joel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.